Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this second in the series of lectures under the general title of A Philosophical Garden. I thought it might be good just to give a little background to that description. And where it comes from is a statement that the new leader of the school, Mr. Donald Lambie, received from His Holiness Sri Shantananda Saraswati immediately following the death of Mr. Leon McLaren, the original leader of the school, in 1994. And what was actually said was this: as the self, Mr. McLaren will be ever present. He leaves the organization in his own image. The development and eventual fulfillment of this philosophical garden is the propitious responsibility of his successor and his disciples. Now, we wouldn't tend to use the term, I suppose, disciples in these Western parts, but I think we get the general idea that a responsibility has been laid upon this school to endeavour to cultivate this philosophical garden, which has many different sorts of plants, represented, of course, by the various pursuits which the school is engaged in and which society more widely is engaged in. So this is a responsibility, and this series of lectures is just one small part in what I think is a much greater process to endeavour to fulfil the responsibility by cultivating the philosophical garden. This evening the lecture is on the subject of law and economics, and it's also doubling, as it were, with the annual Law and Economics lecture. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Mr. Ian Mason, known, I think, to many, if not all of you, as the head of Law and Economics in the School of Economic Science. I won't take the gardening analogy too far. In fact, I think I'd better leave it straight away, because when I said to him shortly before this event, is there a title to your lecture? He said, well, it's just Law and Economics, but you could give it the subtitle, Standing on the Shoulder of Giants. And I can't really make a link between that and gardens. So at that point, I will hand over to Mr. Ian Mason, Standing on the Shoulders of Giants. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much indeed for turning up on this evening to hear a lecture excitingly entitled Law and Economics. I too tried to make the link between gardening and giants, and also gave up when I got to the stage of thinking of the giant as possibly statues in the garden, which I think would not be quite fair on the people that I'm going to speak about this evening. I'm going to speak primarily about four people. The first is a man named Henry George, a 19th century American economist. The second, a former Labour Member of Parliament, a man called Andrew McLaren. The third, his son, Leon McLaren, who was the effective founder of the School of Economic Science. And the fourth, and I think largest of them all, Sri Shantananda Saraswati, Shankaracharya of Jyotirmath, who gave many years of philosophic guidance to Mr. McLaren, Mr. Leon McLaren, and through him to the School of Economic Science. What they all had in common was an appreciation, I think, of the sheer beauty of lawfulness. And I hope in the course of this lecture to be able to draw out from this subject some of the beauty of law, the beauty of the laws that govern economics, and the beauty of the law in its more traditional sense, the laws that govern people in their life in societies. But to do that, I want to start, if I may, with the lecture that Mr. Lambie gave in introducing this series a few weeks ago. He was speaking about philosophy and giving an introduction to the philosophy that was propounded by Shantananda Saraswati, and which is taught and practiced in the school. It goes under the Sanskrit name of Advaita. The word simply means not to. It's a philosophy, primarily a philosophy of unity. It's a philosophy that tries to look beyond the differences between people and things to the ultimate reality, which is a single unified reality which unifies all things, all beings. It's sometimes described simply as existence. All the things that we know, have you ever noticed this? All the things that we know exist, even if they only exist as a figment of our imagination. There is nothing that we know that doesn't exist in some form. And that existence gives a sense of this common foundation to everything. Everything exists in some form. It's sometimes known simply as consciousness. That extraordinary quality or faculty which is available to us, which gives us life, gives us the possibility of knowing and understanding, and which we perhaps feel most fully when we are most happy. And that is also a feature which Shantananda stressed throughout all his long discourses, that if there wasn't bliss at the heart of it, then somehow we'd miss the point. Whether it's possible to convey that bliss in the course of law and economics remains to be seen. In the Indian tradition, this Advaita is referred to as Atman, the self of all, the one self, the individual self, which in its universal aspect is also known as Brahman, and the two are the same. And I suppose the heart of Mr. Lambie's address was to say that this Brahman, this self, this existence, this Advaita alone is real, and the rest is unreal. But I think it has to be said only relatively unreal, and to be treated by us as though we were actors in a play, and we can then participate in that play most fully. And one of the features of the teaching of Shantananda was that participation in the play meant understanding the laws which governed it, knowing the plot, you might say. And it's arguable, you might also say, that we've rather lost the plot, and that's one of the reasons why humanity finds itself in the difficulties in which it does find itself at the present time. So let me turn to the first of these giants among men that I wanted to speak to. Mr. Henry George, the American economist. He was born in 1839 and died in 1897. He's best known for his first published book, a book called Progress and Poverty, which was privately published in 1879. He wrote it having had what could only be described as a checkered career. As a young man, as a teenager, he shipped aboard a ship and sailed from America. He was born and brought up in Philadelphia. He sailed to Australia and then to India and then back to America again and got a sense of the world before he was 20 years old from that voyage. He joined the California Gold Rush and was an unsuccessful prospector on the West Coast. He suffered a period of near destitution whilst on the West Coast, but he had trained as a typesetter. And eventually he got a job, I think in the San Francisco Times, as a typesetter. And finding an empty space in the newspaper on one occasion, he wrote, typeset, and printed an article all by himself. His editor at first refused to believe that he'd actually written it, but having been convinced, allowed him to go on writing, and so he became a journalist. And what concerned him more than anything was what he described as the extraordinary juxtaposition of progress and poverty. And what he saw in the United States of America, which of course at that time was developing very rapidly, was that as the economy became more sophisticated and more active, a strange phenomenon appeared. And that was that suddenly, or perhaps not suddenly, but gradually, but quite quickly, poverty also appeared alongside the progress that was obviously taking place. And this troubled him. It troubled him deeply. And he thought about it again and again and again until he eventually spotted what he saw to be the key to the problem. What he noticed was that wherever there was land available for people to go and work on, people would go and work there, and although they might have a hard time, they were not destitute and they did not live in poverty. And what he noticed also was that as soon as the population progressed, as soon as communities began to develop, all the land was taken into private ownership. And what he saw then was that those who were able to hold it in private ownership could hold everybody else to a sort of ransom. Thomas Carlyle, he quotes in Progress and Poverty, describing the same phenomenon. The widow is gathering nettles for her children's dinner. A perfumed seigneur, delicately lounging in the Œil de Bœuf, I assume that to be a luxurious restaurant, but I'm not sure, hath an alchemy whereby he will extract from her the third nettle and call it rent. And that was really what he spotted, that the private owner of land was in a position to extract rent from people who worked. And there he saw the difficulty. But there was more to him than just a sort of economic insight of this kind. He was a man of enormous mind, with a very large scope. And his starting place was really the whole universe, which he saw to be governed ultimately by laws. And he expressed himself, I suppose, I'm going to try and summarise Progress and Poverty, if that's possible, in a few short sentences. His starting proposition is that the universe is under God and under law. His second proposition, the ultimate laws are the laws of nature. Human laws and human beings are governed by human nature. The law for any creature is the nature of that creature. And he saw human affairs being governed by laws of nature, just as all the subject matter of the natural sciences was governed by laws of nature. And his inquiry really was into the laws, the natural laws, governing economics. He then concluded that under natural law, the land belongs to no one. After all, it was all there before we were. And no one sort of sat waiting for us to be born and said, you can have that bit, and you can have that bit. It's just there. A gift to humanity, and indeed to all creatures who depend upon it. So his view was that the land belonged to no one, and his conclusion from that was that private property in land was the primary cause of human poverty. And in his view, there was a remedy for that. His remedy, an annual tax on the unimproved value of land. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that particular subject this evening. What I can tell you, though, is that on the 18th of November, Saturday the 18th of November, there is a seminar on the subject to be held just across the road at Mandeville Place, where speakers who are better qualified than I am to speak on the subject will tell you all about it. His conclusion in Progress and Poverty was this. A consideration of the manner in which the speculative advance of land values cuts down the earnings of labour and capital and checks production leads, I think, irresistibly to the conclusion that this is the main cause of those periodical industrial depressions to which every civilised country and all civilised countries together seem increasingly liable. And he then devoted his life, the rest of his life, to advancing what he saw as the cause of humanity. In his final speech, which was given in the course of an election campaign in New York, he was a candidate to be mayor of New York in 1897, and his final speech, he concluded with, or rather I think he began, he was introduced as a friend of labour. And he said, I'm not a friend of labour. He said, I stand for equal rights of all men. And that was his approach. He thought that all human beings had an equal right to be here, an equal right to live, and that living should be a good living and a prosperous living. It's interesting that the last part of his book, Progress and Poverty, is entitled The Law of Human Progress. and among the five or six chapters in that part of the book is one entitled The Central Truth, because here was a man who was concerned with human progress and with truth. The poverty, he writes, which in the midst of abundance pinches and embrutes men, and all the manifold evils which flow from it spring from a denial of justice. In permitting the monopolization of the opportunities which nature freely offers to all, we have ignored the fundamental law of justice. For so far as we can, as far as we can see, when we view things upon a large scale, justice seems to be the supreme law of the universe. But by sweeping away this injustice and asserting the rights of all men to natural opportunities, we shall conform ourselves to the law. We shall remove the great cause of unnatural inequality in the distribution of wealth and power. We shall abolish poverty, tame the ruthless passions of greed, dry up the springs of vice and misery, light in dark places the lamp of knowledge, give new vigour to invention and a fresh impulse to discovery, substitute political strength for political weakness, and make tyranny and anarchy impossible. You can hear that he had a way with words. And you can hear, I think, also the emotional force of this rather extraordinary man. At his funeral, interestingly enough, on the 31st of October 1897, it said that 100,000 people lined the streets of New York to watch the cortege as it proceeded to the funeral. His book was the second largest selling book in the 19th century. The largest selling book was the Bible. He died at the height of an election campaign, which many thought that he was likely to win. And that, I think, oddly enough, was the apotheosis of his ideas in America. Thereafter, this vision for which he stood seemed to die away in America, and a few states took up some of the ideas and applied them in a slightly half-hearted way, and some still do. About human progress, he said, "Human progress is not the improvement of human nature. The advances in which civilization consists are not secured in the constitution of man, but in the constitution of society. They are thus not fixed and permanent, but may at any time be lost. Nay, are constantly tending to be lost." And what he saw was that there was a real need for human beings to work to achieve human ideals. And he expressed those ideals, ideals of justice, freedom, prosperity, for everyone. And that was the approach, his whole approach, really, to economics. And he was primarily an economist. But he had a hint of a deeper, perhaps more profound understanding. In his book he asks, what then is the meaning of life? Of life absolutely and inevitably bounded by death. To me it seems intelligible only as the avenue and vestibule to another life, and its facts seem explainable only upon a theory which cannot be expressed but in myth and symbol, and which everywhere and at all times the myths and symbols in which men have tried to portray their deepest perception do in some form express. The scriptures of the men who have been and gone, the Bibles, the Zend Avestas, the Vedas, the Dhammapadas, and the Qurans, the esoteric doctrines of old philosophies, the inner meaning of grotesque religions and dogmatic constitutions of ecumenical councils, the preachings of Foxes and Wesleys and Savonarolas, the traditions of Red Indians and beliefs of black savages, have a heart and core in which they agree, a something which seems like the variously distorted apprehensions of a primary truth. And in a way, all his life, he was groping towards this, himself a deeply religious man, with a profound, energetic, and emotionally charged social conscience, governed, I think, by reason. So that was his message, that there are profound truths for human beings to understand, and that they lie behind the surface, as it were, of life, the surface in which justice, equity, and so on matter in the affairs of men. When he died in 1897, the second of these great giants among men, Mr. Andrew McLaren, was 14 years old. There he is. You'll notice perhaps particularly his hair. It was once said of him that his hair was rather like his view of life. One half black, the other half white. There was no grey. And that in a way sums him up. He saw things very clearly. He was brought up in Glasgow in the Gorbals. He was apprenticed as an engineer, having first of all run away to be a monk, St. Augustine's Abbey, by Loch Ness, and been sent back by the abbot because his father hadn't given him permission to retire from the world. In a way, he never forgot his ambition to become a monk, and he never quite realised it either. Instead, he went on to become a Member of Parliament for nearly a quarter of a century. When he was in his early 20s, I suppose the Georgist ideas reached their height in liberal England in the 1909 People's Budget of Lloyd George. There was a provision for the taxation of land values which Henry George had been advocating. It was a liberal message advocated by the Liberal Party, again on the same sort of foundation that Henry George had worked, that everyone has a right to be here, everyone has a right to live and to live well, and everyone has a right to the means of doing so. Well, the People's Budget, first of all, had to get through Parliament, and that caused a constitutional crisis, which was eventually resolved by a royal intervention, saying that he would create enough peers to pass the budget if the House of Lords wouldn't pass it of their own volition. So they did. But that delayed matters for a couple of years, and then the Great War disposed of the measure almost completely. Andrew McLaren emerged from the Great War with a highly charged political conscience, living by then in Wimbledon. He'd moved from Glasgow, but he became MP for Burslem in the Potteries in 1922 and remained MP until 1945. If you want to know more about it, the book that I've taken the portrait from, Standing for Justice by John Stewart, is readily available and a fascinating read, not only for the life of this second extraordinary man, but for its account of the foundation of the School of Economic Science and for its account of the history of the times in which he lived. And this was, of course, the period really between the wars. He can campaign vigorously during that period for economic justice. Whenever he gave a speech, he advocated the taxation of land values. He announced that it was Labour Party policy. I'm not sure that he ever consulted the Labour Party about this. And so it's perhaps not surprising that he ended his time in Parliament as an independent Member of Parliament. And because he was standing as an independent, when the Labour landslide occurred in 1945, he found himself not only without a seat, but without a deposit, having served his constituents for nearly 25 years. It was said of him that he was unlike any other socialist in that he didn't want to abolish dukes. He wanted everybody to be a duke and to live like one. But although his sort of obvious career is his political career, and his obvious love, his obvious passion, I suppose, was for the land question, what he called the land question, here too was a remarkably rounded man, a much larger man than the objective facts might at first display. He had a great love of law. He had a great love of beauty, and he saw the beauty in the law. He was an artist, and an accomplished artist and calligrapher. He was called upon by the National Gallery to help to restore some of the paintings there and to advise on the restoration of paintings. One of his pictures, a portrait of Neville Chamberlain, is to be found at the National Portrait Gallery. He was an artist of some distinction. He also had a great love of music. And what he saw was that these were things which were natural to human beings. One would often hear him. I came across him in the last 3 or 4 years of his life, and he would give discourses and lectures from time to time. And you would hear him lamenting the number of concert pianists, or possible potential concert pianists, who had had to grind out their lives in factories and in poverty. He had a very sharp wit. Of his son, Leon McLaren, he wouldn't let anyone else criticise his son, Leon McLaren, but he occasionally did. He said, "Some men's sons take to drink, some to economics." And he rather lamented Leon McLaren's early enthusiasm for economics, but I shall come back to that in a moment. Perhaps his happiest moment was in May 1931, when a Labour Party bill to tax land values was passed in the House of Commons. But his happiness was short-lived. It lasted a month or two. Then came a financial collapse, a national government, and the end of that particular movement to the taxation of land values. Well, the essence of his message was simple. Land. You cannot live without land. And that gives access to air, water, and sunshine. And you may notice the mnemonic, laws, which makes it easy to remember. He liked that too. Land, air, water, and sunshine. He would roar at people even at the age of 93. That's what you need to live. And he saw it this way. Whatever the future holds for us, one thing clearer than all else is knowledge of the law, which alone would surely make harmonious music of life. So here was another man who had a great passion for and interest in the law. And he loved the truth. In the House of Commons in February 1937, he said, "Whether it be politics, philosophy, religion, or anything else, the one cardinal characteristic of truth is simplicity. The greatest truths that man ever heard were spoken in the language of simplicity in the streets of Jerusalem. Simplicity and truth stand together. And whenever you get complexity, beware, because there is a falsity somewhere." Whether the House of Commons quite grasped this particular message, I leave you to decide for yourselves. In 1910, his son, Leon McLaren, was born. There he is. Leon McLaren, it's impossible to give a thumbnail sketch of Leon McLaren. That's the first thing I think I should make clear. But it is important, I think, in understanding the way that philosophy has worked and lit up the subjects in the school to know a bit about him. At the age of 16, in 1926, he asked his mother what this book was that his father kept going on about, and was told it was Progress and Poverty. And so he read Progress and Poverty and decided that at the age of 21 he would do something about it. And he did. By then he had read or was reading to become a barrister. And he became a barrister. Well, that was his life's work, to be a barrister. At least that's how he earned his living. His life's work took shape in the 1930s when he began teaching economics. And he taught the economics of Henry George. And he was clearly inspired by it, by George's love of law, his love of justice, and his love of truth. He was inspired also, I think, by his extraordinary capacity to use words. And he himself worked extremely hard to gain a mastery of the English language so that he too could speak and speak effectively. In the early 1940s, during the war, he wrote a book called The Nature of Society. It was his book on economics. I think I'm right in saying, I may be corrected here, but I think I'm right in saying he completed it, or rather, he got to the point in 1944 when he didn't quite see where to go next. He was a bit frustrated. He managed to finish the book. And like Henry George, he too ends with a chapter on the law of human progress. He too saw that human life is a progression, that there is room for human beings to grow and develop. And like Henry George and like his father before him, he thought that everyone should have the opportunity to do so. I'll try and give you just a flavour of what his thinking was like at that time. The full use of the gifts which have been granted to man are one of the essentials of real progress. And the man who does not exercise and expand them does not understand what living means. A right to live is precisely the right of every individual, equally with everyone else, to select his own objectives in life and to pursue them in his own way, provided always that in so doing he does not hamper others in the exercise of their equal rights. Now clearly, if an equal right to live means anything at all, it means that every man has an equal right to those things freely supplied by nature without which he cannot live, to the natural resources of the universe. To deny a man this is to deny him his right to live at all, for without access to land, man must perish. From this it further follows that everyone has a duty to respect this right. The man who claims this land is mine acts in breach of this duty. Private property in land is against the moral law. Like Henry George, like his father before him, that was what he maintained. The difficulty, of course, is that everybody had land. You can imagine this was not a particularly popular message. And although he tried to advance it on the political platform, he didn't get very far. But like Henry George, he saw that there was a way of, as it were, squaring the circle, of reconciling the obvious need for human beings to have access to land with, as he put it, the moral law, against individual claims to land. It is idle, he writes, to say that a man has a right to the full product of his labour unless he is assured of equal access to land with every other man. Here appears a contradiction which has caused much of the idle dispute between conservative and socialist. The idle dispute between conservative and socialist, of course, was the meat and drink of political debate from the early 19th century onwards. If a man is to be secure in the products of his labour, he must occupy a piece of land, whether it be room for his house and garden, room for his office or factory bench, or room for his crops. Every man in his work takes up space, which he must of necessity use to the exclusion of others. To say, therefore, that every man has an equal right of access to land is as much as to say that a man has a right of exclusive possession of a piece of land. This, at first sight, seems to contradict the proposition that private property in land is immoral. As usual, however, the contradiction disappears upon closer observation. And his resolution was simply this: if every landholder were to yield the full rent of his land to a common fund, divisible equally amongst all men, and if further he maintained the land in good condition, then he would be admitting the full ownership to be vested equally in all. And that was the simplicity of his solution in the economic realm. On the subject of human progress, to sum up, the first requirements of human progress are that human beings should live in a community, and that the community should be ordered so as to conform to the principles of being, to the natural laws governing life in society. To the extent that the social organisation is at variance with these natural laws, the community will fail in its purpose. There has been of late a welcome flowering of philosophical thought, drawing its inspiration largely from those old Eastern civilizations which gain such deep understanding in the subjective mode. And if this prospers, it may enrich and balance the intensely objective knowledge of the material sciences. East and West have both failed, however, in their economic arrangements. And this failure has defeated the first principles of human progress. Men and women live in communities so that they may be free to grow and create. They rarely go to war because they want to fight, but are driven to it by the denial of their fundamental duties to each other. Ultimately, he ends his book, it is an individual choice. Only the individual can desire. Only the individual can labour. Only the individual can know, and only the individual can choose. He was, if nothing else, an enthusiastic individualist, and certainly a very large individual. Well, there he was. By the end of the war, that was the way that he was thinking. But that thinking, I think, caused his mind to turn to philosophy. He first of all found some inspiration and insight in the work of P.D. Uspensky and his followers, which led him into the esoteric realm and to some extent into the subjective mode that he's speaking of, inspired by the Eastern civilizations. But it was in 1965 that he had the first of the conversations with Shantananda Saraswati. There isn't time to recount how all that happened, but I wasn't around at the time, so it would be a second-hand account in any case. Shantananda Saraswati, this splendid man, gave guidance through conversations on philosophic matters to Leon McLaren until Mr. McLaren's death in 1994. The very first conversation opens in this way. I think there had been some sort of report about the school preceding it. But what he said was this, or what Shantananda said was this: it is not my desire which has to be carried out. The desire which has to be helped is that which arises in people looking for the truth, wishing to acquire the divine life and to make efforts in that direction. And so far as I can, I will always be ready. My door is always open to anyone, known or unknown, Eastern or Western, irrespective of his upbringing or culture. Because, in fact, we all come from the same stock. As long as that desire and the decision are strong, permanent and stable, the help will always be available. And then he said this: with the first impulse of creation, the system is embodied in the Veda. All knowledge is embodied in them. With the help of the Veda and Shastra, people can lead a natural life. But in this great drama, due to multifarious movements in the creation, when people are in illusion and forget the real part, taking themselves to be true, then it becomes necessary that some direction be given to them, so that they can understand their part which has to be played, and played nicely. For that purpose, certain people, the agents of the Creator, remain in the world, so as to give fresh impulses to them, so that they may be brought to the natural way of living. There is nothing better, no other action can be more suitable to a human being than to correct the ways of all those who have forgotten the way. There are a number of themes in that opening passage to what turned into a 30-year conversation. First, we all come from the same stock, an expression of that same unity that Henry George spoke of, that inspired Andrew and Leon McLaren even before this meeting had taken place. This system embodied in the Veda, he was later to explain, there is a collection of books called the Veda, and they are most highly regarded scriptures in the Indian philosophic and religious tradition. In India, they don't distinguish between religion and philosophy in quite the way that we do in the West. But he said, the Veda are not books. They are the natural laws that are the nature of the universe. And it was, I think, an important part of his teaching that we human beings have this power of reason to come to understand these laws and to live in accordance with them. And so when we talk about the natural laws and understanding the natural laws, we're talking about understanding the Veda in the sense that Shantananda Saraswati explained them to us, as the nature of the universe in which we live, including our own human nature and the nature of society and societies in which human beings organize themselves. The Shastra are essentially, I think, writings about the Veda which expound them and tell us more about leading a natural life. And that, again, I think, is another continual theme throughout the conversations that follow. That it is possible to live naturally, and that living naturally is not some kind of primitive existence, but is in fact a civilized existence which enriches and fulfills the wholeness of what it means to be a human being. So in this sense also, he really confirmed the idealism of the other three giants that I've been speaking about. He confirmed that human beings are supposed to live well within this creation. But he did add this rather special dimension of pointing out that the other aspect, and an all-important aspect of human life, is to seek out the divine life, to enjoy, as it were, a spiritual life, to follow a spiritual path, leading ultimately to liberation. And again, in speaking of liberation, he spoke of the personal emancipation, the personal freedom that it is possible to experience if the human being fully develops their capacity and potential as a human being. And it's this sense of the possibility of being a wholly free individual that I think is reflected in the idealism of free nations and free societies living in free association within this highly differentiated creation. So that was the opening thing. I think another important feature of this, he speaks about people, the agents of the Creator, remaining in the world so as to give fresh impulses to them, so that they may be brought to the natural way of living. I think that meant us. And I think what he was saying there was that in order to follow the spiritual path, to follow the subjective mode that Mr. McLaren had spoken of 20 years before, it wasn't necessary to retire into a monastery, to withdraw from the world and leave it to go its own way, but that quite the opposite, that the nature of the school and the people who'd gathered in it under the impulse of this study of economics and then philosophy was in fact to be a service to society and to the nation and to humanity, and ultimately, he was to say, to the universe. Because those were the great circles in which he saw human beings actually living. Time and again in the conversations, he reminds us of this, reminding us to work on the wisdom that we can derive from hearing the conversations, understanding them, and practicing what is advised. And to apply that wisdom in the world around us, to be of service to society, to be of service to the nation, and so on. And as you'll see in this series of lectures, that form of service has opened up in all sorts of different ways. In education, music, art, Renaissance studies, you'll get a sample of some of them if you continue to attend this series of lectures over the next few months. But that was the great inspiration. And at the heart of it all, the Veda. Now, under this impulse, Mr. McLaren wanted to inspire the study of law in the school, or re-inspire the study of law in the school. There were a number of lawyers, young lawyers. I was one of them. And so in 1973, he formed a law group. And you might get a sense from what he said to that law group when it started, how things had moved on. I spoke at the outset of the principle of Advaita, the essential existence, the Atman, Brahman, often referred to in the course of these conversations as the Absolute. And I tell you that because it's the term that's used here. This is what Mr. McLaren said about the study of law. This study is about how first principles have been used in English law and how it has worked out. Law is the will of the Absolute, and the whole creation is a manifestation of that will. The nature of the Absolute is a body of law, and the will of the Absolute works through this, so that everything happens naturally without any force or pressure. The human being's function and nature is to find its way back to the Absolute from a position of ignorance. This function, being natural to man, is lawful. The human law, according to the ancients, is based on this. This was the criterion of law. Did it take man back? If it did, it was good law. If not, it was bad law. Like his father before him, he saw things in black and white. There was little grey. And that was the principle that he offered to the law group, and to a slight digest of it. And the law group proceeded to study, and still does. Its studies were based on the scriptures, starting with the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, and later the Upanishads, which reflect the Veda, the natural laws in the nature of things. We looked also at the great legal authorities, starting with Plato and those wonderful dialogues with Socrates. I remember Mr. McLaren telling us that it wasn't very easy to get to grips with Plato's dialogues. It wasn't easy stuff. And he said, keep at it, work at it. He speaks with the language of reason. And you need to lift the mind to the level of the argument. And from being almost wholly incomprehensible to start with, and extremely difficult to digest and make sense of, gradually through application and study and discussion and not a little argument, the mind did in a sense grow, I think, to accommodate these works and the insight they gave into law and legal affairs. And of course, I suppose you'd say one of Plato's most central messages was that a well-ordered society can only exist if the people in it are what he called virtuous, if they practice the great virtues, wisdom, temperance, courage, and justice. And in some of the dialogues, he adds piety to those. Lawfulness was an individual matter for Plato, and a lawful society was a society of lawful individuals. And in that, Shantananda Saraswati was saying almost exactly the same thing. We were delighted also to be introduced to the great English legal commentator, Sir William Blackstone. Law, he said, in its most general and comprehensive sense, signifies a rule of action. And it is that rule of action which is prescribed by some superior and which the inferior is bound to obey. And a direct reflection of Shantananda, and indeed of what Mr. McLaren has said to us, natural law is the will of the Creator. You can find it in the second chapter of the first book of Blackstone's commentaries. And Blackstone's commentaries, incidentally, are still referred to by some of our more erudite lawyers in support of arguments in the courts to this day. We were asked to look at the common law of England because it was seen and regarded as a practical application of natural law. One of the interesting features about the common law of England is that it is really based on custom. And custom, to a large extent, is what people do naturally. And what the lawyers tried to do, the judges, as they developed the common law, was to turn what people did naturally into the laws of the land, so that the law proceeded, as Mr. McLaren suggested, without any force or pressure. It was really a development of the natures of the people. And one of the things that was very clear is that it was the English way of doing things. And it's also clear, I think, that not everybody does things the same way. And you can't just assume that because it works this way in England, it's going to work this way everywhere. In England, for example, there was the great principle that reason is the life of the law. And the common law itself, said Sir Edwin Cook in the 17th century, is nothing else but reason. Judges give reasons for their decisions. And it's the reasoning that is actually the law of the land. Because in the Platonic sense, a man who's governed by reason is unlikely to transgress the law. It was that sort of insight that really that was derived from looking at things in this way. We were also encouraged to see the study as a service to society. The law group continues to work in this way. At the present time, in this age of globalization, in this age of what is sometimes described as the clash of civilizations, in these times when there is far more communication than ever before between peoples of wholly different backgrounds and philosophic and religious traditions, it's obviously important, because people have to deal with each other and because there is so much intercommunication, to find some common principles by which we can all live in harmony and peace. And I think we all feel and all know there's a certain kind of tension in the world at the present time as to just how long the harmony and peace can be maintained and to what extent we can prevent the differences between people overcoming what we have in common. This sense of natural laws at the very heart of creation, at the very heart of the world we live in, at the very heart of humanity, does give a direction. It does give a sense that there are some common principles towards which it would be possible to work, and which might unite people of many different religious and cultural backgrounds. Principles of justice and equity, this sense of freedom, are among the principles which it may be possible to unite a world around. And so at present, the Law Society is examining how international law could be directed in order to make the most of those traits which are common in human beings, and, as it were, overcome the differences and find some common ground. And they're looking to see how the United Nations in particular could help develop a global consciousness of a natural way of living together in harmony and in peace. This is not, I might add, a particularly easy task. And sometimes we feel ill-equipped to approach it. But in 1983, Shantananda Saraswati sent a message to Mr. McLaren. I believe it was in a letter. Let me read what he said. All over the world, duality has penetrated on a grand scale. All societies feel troubled and terrified. The reign of fear causes reasonable welfare of the people to be ignored deliberately, while violent tendencies are being encouraged in a planned manner. The brilliant and sharp intelligence of the school, based on the philosophy of Advaita Vedanta, should be used on the following subject: establishment of justice and equity for the welfare of humanity in the universe now. Well, that's quite an order, isn't it? There is something about
this brilliant and sharp intelligence of the school, this phrase that he used, because none of us feel particularly brilliant, sharp, or intelligent. But there is something about the manner of work in the school and in groups and with groups which brings out a sort of collective consciousness which is greater than that of any of the individuals concerned. And I think it's important to mention this because it's a form of group working which I think is rare in the academic institutions which address the same sort of issues, and where it is very often a particular person and their academic development and their line of argument which is being advanced. What we try to do in the school is to let our personal attachments to particular ideas go and share the ideas, listen, argue, discuss, debate, not with a view to establishing our point of view, but with a view to discovering the truth of the matter. And in those circumstances, when one can be shown to be completely wrong, one is grateful rather than offended. And this helps the process forward. And it does, I think, develop a simplicity of view and an ability to address issues which might not otherwise be available to us. So that's part of the influence that Shantananda's guidance has made possible, part of a process that's been made possible. This working together in groups, working to discover the truth of a particular subject as best we can. What does he mean, establishment of justice and equity? That, of course, raises the obvious questions: what is justice, what is equity, and so on. And again, in the light of the way that Shantananda expounds the Vedic philosophy and the Vedas themselves, the natural laws, one comes to the conclusion that justice is not some sort of average or mean or middle point between two extremes, but rather that it really is the full expression of what was referred to earlier as the will of the Absolute. The will of the Absolute, according to Shantananda, is simple: knowledge, bliss, health, and freedom for everybody. And that's as clear and good a definition of justice as I've come across, and one which I'm happy to work with for the present time. And what about equity? Equity, to Shantananda, is the Advaita. It is the unity. It is that in which everything comes together as one. The purpose of equity in English law, incidentally, was to bring people together and resolve disputes. Equity is the Advaita, the unity. And in one answer he said simply, truth has been ignored. In ignorance, injustice abounds. Injustice has shattered the equity of the Atman, and the consequence is loss of bliss. And the starting point is ignoring the truth. What is this truth that is ignored? I think he would answer most simply by saying it is the Advaita, it is the unity, it is the essential selfhood of us all that is the same. And of course, you can imagine, can't you, if we were all working from an understanding that fundamentally there was no difference between us, that what unites us, as it was put by an economist the other day, what unites us is in fact far greater than what divides us. And if all our efforts were directed to discovering what unites us, in a clear understanding that there is a single unifying principle, then our approach to all sorts of problems would be very different. And that's the way we try to approach things in the school, looking for what unites us, trying to overcome the fact that we are quite often and quite easily distracted by the differences and the things that divide us. As far as the economics in the school is concerned, if I can conclude with just a few words about that, the main effort remains to offer courses to the public Courses have been offered to the public continuously, year in, year out, since 1945. They were being offered before that, but I'm not quite sure how continuously. But there are certainly records of them being offered even during the Second World War. What we attempt to show is how national and international economies can work in harmony with natural law. How the conventional standard approach to economics conforms to natural law, and where we think it departs from natural law, and what differences might be made, what directions might be taken to improve our economic arrangements in accordance with the sense of knowledge, health, freedom and bliss for everyone. Whenever Shantananda Saraswati was asked about economics, what were the primary laws of economics, he always said, first thing is truth. And from truth, of course, in the ordinary day-to-day economic realm, you derive honesty and integrity. And again, an economy that runs on the basis of honest and integrity is far easier to organise and participate in than one which ignores the truth in just that simple sense. Shantananda also spoke of the importance of love. The principle in English law, of course, is to love your neighbour as yourself, which becomes in law, you must not injure your neighbour. And it works just as well in economics. To treat your neighbours, to treat those with whom you trade within the global economy, as your neighbours and friends, and act in a way which does not injure your neighbour, is quite a good economic principle. And it's one which would have a dramatic effect on the way the global economy works at the present time, if it was universally applied. All this talk of exploitation, all this removal of wealth from some people's hands, the presentation of it into others, might soon cease if that simple attitude were adopted. Now, we do accept this is an idealistic view, and you cannot expect everyone to adopt the law of love. Even the common law doesn't expect that. It just provides a remedy when people injure their neighbour. And economics needs, in a way, to develop practices which guard against injury and promote healthy commerce. And the other principle which runs through it all is the principle of service, a sense that you might give a little more than you get, and that your idea is to, in a way, set your own standards, do the best for yourself, in the sense of doing the best job you possibly can, and in pleasing yourself, you please your customer. Mr. McLaren, in the early material, put it this way. He said, the best of life is in giving, and it is by our giving that we live, and therefore that we should value our contribution. And so that's a sort of aspect of what we offer in the economics course. Under the impulse of philosophy, groups continue to work on economic theory to refine the understanding and expression of principles of economics in accordance with natural laws. We studied things like feeding the world, how we deal with the extraordinary inequities in the world food situation. We look at the nature of society, how it is structured, how it is governed, and how it can comply and does comply with the natural laws. We look at land issues and questions of land, at taxation, at climate change, which is, of course, the topic of the moment, and the whole question of economics and the environment, because one cannot help feeling that the natural way of living would have a far less devastating effect on our environment than what you might call the way we live now. And I think, again, I hope entirely consistently with Shantananda, our primary conclusion is that the real answer to human difficulties is actually human development. That somehow human beings have to raise their consciousness to take account of each other, of the whole human race with which we are now intimately involved, with the many countless thousands of beings with which we share this planet, the planet itself, and its place in the universe. Human development means becoming more aware of these things and acting in accordance with that awareness. And in that sense, I think it can be said that human development is taking place, not simply in the school, not even, I suspect, because of the school, but in humanity as a whole. There is an awareness, a growing awareness, a wider consciousness of the urgent need to address the difficulties that humanity and our planet face. The difficult step, I suppose, is to take it from the grand scale back to the individual scale and accept that this might actually mean some change in the way that we live. Finally, what we're finding is that Mr. McLaren was justified in his hope, expressed in The Nature of Society, that the deep understanding in the subjective mode, which has been very fully developed in the conversations with Shantananda Saraswati, could enrich and imbalance the intensively objective knowledge of the material sciences. So that's what we're trying to do, what we're working on in the economics courses at the present time. Shantananda, lastly, and I mean lastly this time, left us with a prayer. Prayer which I think fulfills his direction that we should hold human idealism high, which he says should be with us day in, day out, which he says is the prayer which the wise wake up to every morning. May all be happy. May all be without disease. May all creatures enjoy well-being and none be in misery of any kind. As an expression of a sort of emotional attitude and of an intent in the formulation of economic policy and of laws for nations, it seems to me one can do little better than that. It gives an all-encompassing view. It includes everyone, every being, all creatures. And so that's what we keep in front of us. In this sense, the truth, prayer, these directions, they're rather like the North Star. It may be that you don't quite get there. It may be that you don't achieve them in your personal being. But they do at least give you a sense of direction. They point you in a particular direction. The direction that Shantananda points us to is to take a universal view, to see this play of the human life within its context in the universe as a whole. And he says also, but be prepared to leave all that and turn inwards, become still, enter into the spiritual realm of unity, bliss, and freedom. And the two go together. They're not incompatible. On his philosophy, they are quite clearly compatible and necessary developments in the growth of a human being. So that's something of a canter through the work of these great giants. Exceptional human beings, all of them. Interestingly, all with a common outlook, given its greatest refinement and breadth by the work of Shantananda Saraswati and the philosophy which he offers.